Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 16th of November, as we record. No reshuffle for us. We are sticking with the existing crack IC team rather than bringing back editors from days of yore. And we've got another packed agenda for you again today. It's been a good week for markets, but we're going to start on a sour note by looking at Diageo's profit warning last Friday. After that, we will turn to a couple of the stronger performers of recent days. That's British Land and Land Securities, both of whom reported interim results this week. And this week in the magazine, it's our annual Investment Trust special, complete with 24-page supplement. So we're going to be discussing some of the insights contained therein as well. Joining me to ponder all of this are, over the line, Chris Akers.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Chris. And Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Alex. And in the studio, Mitchell Labiak.
Hi, Dan.
Val Cipriani.
Hello, Dan.
And Dave Baxter.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, everyone. We're going to start and get the bad news out the way early then, as I mentioned. Chris, Diageo, a trading statement last Friday. They'd had some struggles with their US business over the summer, but the profit warning stemmed from a different source.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's not been a good week for Diageo. The shares fell about 12% after this surprise update where the company cut guidance. So net sales growth is now expected to slow in the first half of the new financial year. And this stems from some quite big issues in its Latin America and Caribbean markets, where net sales are forecast to fall by more than 20%. The company pointed to lower consumption and consumer downtrading in that market, and it's also struggling with getting inventory levels down to the right level there. And this also had an impact on operating profit forecasts. So guidance is now that operating profit growth will slow in the first half of the year, and medium-term guidance was also cut. So not a surprise about the market reaction.
On that note, the question is really whether this is just a blip or the start of something more serious. One analyst note I read did say that 12% was an overreaction in the headline, but then it proceeded in the commentary to sound horrified at the context of what's happened at Diageo. I mean, the company in recent years has talked a lot about the steps it's been taking to avoid this kind of problem, this overstocking issue, which has hit LATAM seemingly. It's been trying to move from, you know, what they say is a sell-in to a sell-out culture, which is effectively trying to sell more directly. So you avoid the kind of disintermediated problems of not knowing what kind of stocks your customers have and whether they've got too much or too little. Nonetheless, LATAM, the business there, does still seem quite disintermediated. And given 6 weeks ago they didn't sound that worried about the region, now, as you say, sales are going to be down 20% year on year in the 6 months to December. It does raise the question of how much visibility they do have there. What's your take on how serious this could be, how long it could take to unwind, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the reaction's been quite mixed on that point. So management argues that this is an isolated incident and it remains a sellout, that the company remains a sellout culture. Analysts, as you mentioned, have been quite scathing. Bernstein said, why did alarm bells not ring much sooner and how did the situation get out of control? So pretty scathing there. Barclays think the company's being a bit too pessimistic with the medium-term guidance cuts, and they're more positive on a bounce back for LATAM moving forwards. But it is clear that there are visibility issues with inventory in the region. The new chief executive, Deborah Crew, has pointed to more limited point-of-sale data in the region, with less visibility over inventory at wholesalers and the retailers that they sell to. So that definitely has a big part to play. I think it's important to remember that the division was facing some pretty strong comparatives. So it grew about 20% in the first half of last year. Mm. It's also a relatively small part of the whole business. It took around 11% of Diageo's total net sales in 2023. So that's something to bear in mind as well.
Yeah, could potentially be a, notwithstanding the timing and the sudden update, you know, Deborah Crew, the new chief exec, relatively new management team, so maybe they're trying to kitchen sink to an extent. As you mentioned, this is just a relatively small part of the business, albeit one that has been growing quickly. And there was some better news in the update, at least over the US, which is 40% of sales still.
Yeah, so North America is Diageo's biggest market and also its highest margin market. It's obviously a key part of the business. The trading update mentioned that the company expects net sales growth in the first half of 2024, which is good news given issues raised about the US over the summer. And it said it's also aiming to maintain distributor inventory in line with historic levels. It also pointed to some green shoots around Christmas holiday spending in the US at the Capital Markets Day yesterday. So things are sounding pretty positive in North America.
Yeah. What came out of that Capital Markets Day? Was there much more, you know, much to add on top of the trading statement last week? What were they interested in?
Yeah. So interestingly, there wasn't much more detail about the issues at LATAM, which is what everyone was sort of focused on, obviously. Deborah Crew said there are action steps being implemented to try and deal with the issues there, but that the market will have to wait until January and the interim results for a bit more detail. In terms of guidance, it reiterated the medium-term guidance set out in the trading update. But they are sort of a bit more bullish on expanding margins over the long run as inflation continues to fall. And they're also going through a supply chain transformation program at the moment, which should help over the longer term with the margin.
Alex, I don't know if you have any thoughts on Diageo as a company in general, or the short-term issues we've seen in the last few days.
Yeah, I mean, this was clearly unexpected. I mean, let's not forget that Warren Buffett bought into the company early this year, apparently detecting traces of his favourite investment of all time, Coca-Cola. But I mean, just to sort of take a step back at some of the reaction. I mean that note that you alluded to earlier, Dan, I read through it as well. I mean, it's clear that analysts are quite shell-shocked at how the management team sounded when sort of discussing and sort of unveiling this issue. So that's bad. And then at the Capital Markets Day, you know, the chief executive, Chris, was saying, said it was difficult to predict when it's going to rebound, sort of bad again. You've got this kind of ugly situation where a very suddenly difficult operating environment has been compounded by what looked like a lack of control and no clear roadmap out of the mess. Of course, we've got to put it in context, as we've been discussing, it's a small part of the business, but it's probably now a wider credibility issue for, you know, Diageo's internal controls that it wasn't able to sniff this out a little earlier. You know, and the result is we got the shares where they were almost 5 years ago, which isn't what you look for with a stock with high margins that's kind of meant to deliver very reliable GDP plus growth. That all said, I did want to just very quickly reflag something Bearbull wrote earlier this year about the company, which is that, you know, the clear weakness in the shares might start to attract rivals because the premium some of its peers in the States are on are considerable, and the valuation of a couple of its kind of comparable rivals is double that of Diageo's. I mean, Diageo is an enormous company to swallow, so we shouldn't get carried away about thinking that there's going to be a bid coming in. You know, even at this markdown price, the enterprise value is about $100 billion, so you'd need a chunky premium to take the company out. But it does have, you know, truly iconic brands in its stable. Its current price might therefore attract a bid for some of those. We have to wait and see. But yeah, a bit of a mire that the company finds itself in at present, and not especially clear how it's going to get out.
Chris, what are your views on the prospects in some? As Alex alluded to or spoke about, you know, Bearbull has been quite positive early this year. Phil Oakley, obviously, who writes for us as well, does like Diageo historically too. How do you see the company, you know, going ahead?
Yeah, so we're a hold on Diageo at the moment, which I think is the right position to be in based on the latest updates. As Alex was saying, it obviously has a leading brand portfolio. Apart from LATAM, it still has some very good trading momentum across its other regions, as we're discussing positive news in the US as well. It's also more widely continuing to take advantage of premiumization, which is a key trend, and that's helping margins, has very strong pricing power. But of course, as Alex was saying, the share price performance hasn't been impressive, now back to the same point as 5 years ago. So I think it's fair to say we've gotten less bullish on Diageo over the last year or so, but I think holds is the right place to be at the moment.
Yeah, I am a bit sceptical on them as well, on some of these shifts, and even in the US where the signs have been a bit better, you know, I think you can see more competitive pressures coming through there, and even, you know, as a consumer, well, not quite staple, but as a consumer company, they've been putting for a lot of price rises, obviously, and that pricing power has come through. But you do wonder if they're going to have to give some of that back soon. But yeah, I think that hold is fair currently, given the strength the business has elsewhere and the potential for things like tequila, which is a strong area of growth in recent years, to continue as well. We'll obviously keep close eyes on the company and as it releases its scheduled and unscheduled, perhaps, updates in future months. But we're going to turn to companies of a different ilk now. Mitch, we're talking about British Land and Land Securities here. Now, obviously, they've had a very tough time of it over the past 18 months, with all the issues we know regarding higher interest rates and the struggles of the property market. This week, though, things have been going very well, and that's not just because of the general sense of positivity about rates peaking. It's also because both companies put out interim results at the start of the week, and they were fairly decent, it's fair to say, in the context of where we've been and where we are now, at least.
Yeah, in the context of that latter part is key. Yeah, I think better than expected is perhaps a good way of talking about it. I think a lot of that was to do with rental growth. Rental growth tends to track economic growth. So with economic growth being better than expected, i.e. flat, net rental income is better than expected, i.e. it's flat. The company was obviously very keen to point out, you know, like for like rental income, which is slightly different for other reasons that we might well get onto. And they were keen to sort of point out their leasing activity. You know, they were saying that this leasing activity, because the rents that are coming in are higher than sort of the market rents, this is a very good thing. And this will mean rents increasing sort of going forward. And analysts are confident about this too. I'm a shade more skeptical, only because if we do tip into a recession, you might imagine sort of cancelled leases and all of those sort of under offer lettings that they're pointing to falling through. But for now, at least, things look slightly better than predicted for both of them.
And what have they been doing to, you know, protect their businesses or shore them up during this tougher time? You know, we can get on to the potential, you know, peaking of rates and things like that in a moment. But obviously, things have been difficult for a while and they've been aware of that. How have they been trying to protect the business as best they can?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is, I mean, a lot of property companies are doing this right now at the moment. They use this phrase, they're recycling assets, which is another way of saying we're going to sell the not very good stuff and we're going to buy good stuff. So that's, and it's quite a risky thing to do, but it's kind of the only thing you can do when your sort of asset values have fallen such that increases your gearing. And REITs, by their very nature, are very sort of reliant on debt. They're often sort of keeping an eye on that. And when you get that double whammy of sort of interest rates making your debt more of a question, and also interest rates dragging down the value of the property, that thereby sort of increases your leverage, and also the leverage becomes more of a problem because interest rates are higher. So what a lot of companies have been doing, and British Land and Landsec are no different, is selling off the stock where they don't think they're going to see much rental increase and buying the stock where there will be higher rental increases. And the success of that has not come through yet in terms of a net rental income. In fact, because they've been net sellers, their net rental income is, that's part of the reason why it's been flat. But they're sort of pointing to the fact that, look, you know, we're moving more towards, in Landsec's case, it's they're moving more towards the West End, where market data would imply that they're going to get sort of better rental returns, and that's protecting their business. Whereas British Land is moving towards retail parks, where there is sort of a fair amount of data, to market data, to back up that they can get rental returns there. In short, they're chasing better rental returns, but they're going at it in slightly different ways, which is somewhat interesting because the two companies are very much, in normal times, they're very much mirror images of each other. But at the moment, they're sort of diverging slightly. I don't want to overplay that point because they're still two very similar companies, but they are diverging.
On the London note, you talked about Landsec and West End. British Land earlier this year, there was a lot of attention, or a decent amount of attention, on the fact that Meta had broken its London office lease. You know, seen as a bit of a canary in the coal mine for London offices. Like, oh, this big company no longer wants to, you know, have this big space, and British Land has got to deal with it. Now, that will have a small impact on earnings per share this year, but it was quite interesting what they said this week about that British Land. They said that Meta had found someone to take it from them, but British Land said, no, we want to do it ourselves, which in some as they portray it, at least, would be seen as a sign of confidence that they can get a better deal and that actually, you know, this is not necessarily a bad thing for them to be re-renting the place or re-leasing at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we never know what, you know, how much of that is sort of jiggery pokery to sort of, you know, get the market excited. We like to imagine that real estate investment trusts are much more sophisticated than people like us when we're buying or selling houses or renting a flat. But it is essentially the same thing, you know, that it's the whole thing of the estate agent coming around saying, oh, well, I've had five people look at the flat today, so you better put an offer in soon. That said, British Land is a listed company. So, I imagine there's a lot of truth in what they're saying. But what I suppose what I'm getting at is the proof will be in the pudding. Meta paid to break that lease in September. It's now November. 2 months with, you know, that vacancy is not world ending, especially if, as they say, you know, oh, there's competition for the space. But I think if no one is in that building by Christmas, or if no one is rumoured or under offer to sort of take it in the trade press, yeah, I think we could start to ask some questions. Because canary in the coal mines, I think that's a fair analogy, because the West End is seen as, you know, the most exciting part of the London office market at the moment, at a time when Canary Wharf is not doing very well at all, and the city is doing slightly better. The West End is seen as this very exciting place. So if they can't let a top of the range West End office, then that will raise questions. But yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, they certainly sounds like they can get a tenant in fairly sharpish, and the market hasn't punished them for it too much yet. So
sure. So
yeah, time will tell.
The retail park side of things, we've talked about that a little bit already, but that is quite interesting to me. The occupancy rates there are pretty high. British Land, they even did a little investor update on them a few weeks ago, because things are clearly going well enough that they can focus on this. But, you know, as opposed to, you know, the high streets and even the shopping centres to an extent, it does seem that retail parks are where those kind of businesses want to be now. And that's working out quite well for British Land at the moment.
Yeah, it's somewhat surprising, because it feels very 50s. So these retail parks, just to give you an idea of what they're buying and what they own. These are your sort of, yeah, they're out of town, enormous car parking spaces, and then lots of sort of big shops. So think of Next Clearances, where there used to be Big W's, you know, back when Woolworths is still trading, where you've got sort of a lot of supermarkets there now. This is what they're talking about. So they're quite old-fashioned entities, and they've been around since the, you know, for a few decades now. They seemed almost kind of a bit outdated. But what sort of led to their revival, a large part of this, it's tied in with online shopping. So they're this sort of, they've accidentally, or perhaps because obviously when these things were built, you know, we did not know the internet shopping would take off. But they've accidentally become this very, they've reinvented themselves as this sort of hybrid shopping model. So you can go there to collect something which you bought online. They can also fulfill online orders. You can, you know, shop there just as a human person as well. So they sort of fit into this, you know, when there are questions around the popularity of online shopping, and also questions around the sort of viability of the high street, these retail parks seem to be doing quite well. Emphasis on quite, because once again, it's all relative in the property market. It's one of the only asset classes of theirs which has recorded a increase in value, but that increase was 0.1%. But even still, at a time when the wider property market is still flailing a bit, that's nothing to be sniffed at. And as you say, they are sort of fully occupied, and they're able to negotiate rental increases on them.
Yeah. A kind of a shift to maybe the US style as well. Obviously, we've had them here for a long time, but they're big business in the US, and maybe that's how our shopping will be done by human persons, as you say, in future. I mean, British Land sounds quite confident as well. I mean, I think they're currently 22% of the portfolio. Management can easily envisage, quote, that rising to a third. So, you know, they seem to be optimistic there.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, because, as I say, there's not a huge number of differences between these two businesses. But to put that in perspective, so at the moment, they own 2.1 billion of these retail parks, and they've got an 8.7 billion portfolio. So as you say, yeah, that's around 23-24%. They're okay with the idea of it going up to a quarter. For a company that's typically been London office and all, you know, and is still heavily weighted towards London offices, it's a big point of difference from Landsec. Landsec does also have these assets, you know, it's not missed the boat entirely, but it owns about 400 million of them in a 10.1 billion portfolio. So that's only 4.1% by contrast. So both in terms of sheer scale and as a percentage of its portfolio, British Land is much more bullish on these retail parks. And you can certainly see why. Maybe I'm just being overly skeptical. The only question I'd have is whether this, a lot of this is driven by a sort of trend at the moment, a trend towards, you know, this is the sort of shopping that we want to do. But if there is another shift in the way we do online shopping, and we've seen many shifts in the way we do shopping in the last decade alone, we've gone from sort of bricks and mortar, but, you know, Hammerson having this very high share price because people love shopping centres, to shopping centres and high street sort of decimation, to the rise of online shopping and all the excitement around warehouses, and now towards retail parks. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that there might be some other changes in consumer behaviour and changes in how we do shopping that would affect the value. But that could just be me being overly pessimistic, because certainly in the short and medium term, they seem to be doing quite well.
I'm going to bring Alex in again now, because as we spoke about at the top, share prices have been going gangbusters to an extent this week. Obviously this is a very rate sensitive sector, and every interest rate forecast change has a big impact on REITs. But you know, if we are getting to a stage where rates are peaking, could we see a bit more of a reassertion of fundamentals? And B, Alex, how do you view the respective business prospects at the moment?
Tricky one. I'm going to probably have to pass on part A. I mean, the story of the last couple of years has been, for the REIT sector, has been the difficulty of separating the fundamentals that Mitch just, you know, outlined really well for the two companies we've been talking about, and the rate environment. So yeah, I mean, unfortunately, in a way, for Land Securities and British Land, it's not possible to say this week that it was all down to them and their, you know, their operational improvements that caused their share prices to go up 14 and 8% over the last 5 days. A big part is going to be sentiment. I mean, we you know, the other part of that is, let's not be, I suppose, too amnesiac in our market outlooks, because a week ago everyone was fretting about, you know, Fed hawkishness, and we've had a couple of good inflation reports. You know, we're inevitably going to be back flipping to the other side in a week or two. So it really comes down to fundamentals for these businesses, because, you know, they can't change the weather of interest rates. You know, in terms of the outlook, you know, Mark Allen, the chief executive of Landsec, I was just looking through some of his commentary. I mean, he's so bullish on the West End, you know, saying that that's where businesses and people want to be. Occupancy there's, you know, pretty much full. And it just seems like, you know, it's such a stronger investment case than the city, and a clearer investment case than the retail park high street dynamic, which is, you know, as Mitch was alluding to, it's kind of hard to see where the wind's blown there. But, you know, prime West End London real estate is, we can say, booming. It had a tough pandemic, but it's now looking a lot stronger. So, you know, which of the two stocks looks better value relative to its prospects? You might say neither. You might say Shaftesbury Capital. You know, they are pure play on the West End, and they've been, you know, they're the experts in this field. So yeah, I kind of a pass on both questions there, Dan. Sorry, but that's
it's all right. That'll do for me. I thought, you know, there was some insight there. That's all we can ask for. I did give you the difficult question of, you know, when will we finally stop focusing on interest rates? But the answer is probably never. Anyway, we're going to turn from real estate investment trusts to investment trusts themselves now, our special this week. We are going to effectively go through a whistle-stop tour of some of our features, because there's a lot in print this week in the supplement and in the main magazine as well. We've spoken a bit on the show in recent weeks about, you know, the inevitable problems. I say inevitable because they haven't changed in recent months. The problems of discounts investment trusts are on, or at least the fact that those discounts aren't closing and seem to be widening. So we're not going to dwell on that too much this time, nor will we talk too much about buybacks. But the first thing I wanted to talk about, Dave, was gearing. And, you know, if we are potentially going for, you know, it's going to see better times ahead, as we all hope we are market-wise as well, it's perhaps no surprise that there have been a few trusts this year who have been upping their gearing. At the same time, you know, these are fraught circumstances, so it's still quite a bold bet at the same time.
Yeah, it certainly seems like a bold bet. So we looked at the equity trusts that have kind of notably increased their gearing from September last year to September this year. And as you'd expect, you have a real mixture of different names in there. But I suppose one of the interesting trends you might pick out is you've seen a handful of UK equity trusts ramping up their gearing, especially a few names, including some BlackRock trusts, among others, whose gearing has really ramped up. I think that's especially interesting just because, you know, small mid caps were hit so hard last year, but now you've had names like BlackRock, Throgmorton, their kind of levels have moved back up. So it is, yeah, it is one of those cases of perhaps the level of risk and reward on offer is quite high, but it's interesting to see those managers kind of make those decisions. And just to turn to one other name, the CT UK High Income Trust has upped its gearing. And in one of their kind of updates, you know, the boards don't always explicitly discuss what they're doing with gearing, but they outline the fact that, you know, with rates potentially closer to being at a peak and in the wake of the Silicon Valley Bank crisis earlier this year, they felt there was a really interesting opportunity to kind of use gearing to add to their holdings and financials.
I should say, for those who don't know, that gearing is effectively the process of leveraging up your portfolio. So when things are going well, your returns are going to be increased, but vice versa as well, hence the level of risk. And there is some risk in doing so at difficult times. We are now going to briefly talk about discounts because, Val, one thing we mentioned in the supplement this week is the interesting fortunes of private equity. And in some ways, it looks like a rare bright spot when you consider the change in those discounts this year. But in others, that is due to one factor in particular.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so basically most of the sectors in the investment trust world, as we know, have seen their discounts go up again from September last year to roughly September this year. And when you look at the private equity data, it is a bit of an exception because actually the average discount seems to be closing by quite a lot. A lot of it is because of one trust, which is 3i Group. That's a very big trust. It's got 18.6 billion in assets, and as such, it kind of like skews the numbers quite a bit, actually for the whole investment trust sector and even more obviously for just private equity. 3i has been performing very well because its basically main asset is Action Group, which is this Dutch discount retailer that has just been performing really, really strongly. And so this trust is a bit of a special kind of case within the sector. And yeah, that's why it's been doing so well. But there's sort of some good news for the other trusts in the sector as well. And here we maybe should say that it's just the private equity sector and not necessarily growth capital as well, which is sort of a bit of a different story. But within private equity, both the direct funds, so the ones that invest directly in private equity assets, and the sort of funds, which have some sort of secondary exposure to other private equity funds, have been doing quite okay, and I have seen the discounts sort of close a little bit. There's probably a few different reasons for that. On one hand, the NAV performance has been doing actually quite okay. It has held up, considering that obviously it's also a sector where interest rates are not necessarily great news. So maybe the impact has not been as bad as maybe some people had expected. And then the other thing that we should probably take into account is that the starting point from last year was really, really very low. So discounts were very wide. So obviously it kind of sort of makes sense that they would start closing a little bit.
Yeah, I think at the start of this year, there was, as you say, that all that concern about how rates would affect private asset valuations. And for a lot of these trusts, those falls haven't materialized to the extent that the discounts might have suggested that they might. So there has been some, if not progress there, then at least a staving off or an avoidance of that worst case scenario. Right, moving on again very quickly. Another feature we have, income, Dave, the income portfolios. Now, we have these every year, but I just wanted for this very brief mini segment to maybe look at, you know, how these portfolios have been constructed this year. Effectively, we try and, or our contributors try and provide two portfolios of income-generating trusts, income-generating assets. And there's a slight discrepancy there at the moment because, of course, on the one hand, a lot of people are looking at bonds nowadays, but there aren't really too many of those in the investment trust space. So really, it comes down to whether you're backing the bombed out equity investment trusts or the bombed out alternative trusts. And we've had kind of a splitting of the ways there, perhaps, with our two contributors.
Yeah, it's kind of a case of pick your different bargain, I guess. But yeah, as you mentioned, David Little, one of our specialists, he takes more of an old school kind of equity income focused approach. So he has some names like Murray International, the Global Income Fund, some UK income funds, some Asia plays. And then he does have a bit of kind of infrastructure and debt and so on. And interestingly, some multi-asset names like Aberdeen Diversified Income and Growth, which had a strategic review recently and then decided they're going to plough on doing things as they are. But the market has not really liked that trust for quite a long time. James Carthew, our other specialist, he has taken a much more alternatives focused approach. What really struck me when he was kind of outlining his portfolio this year is just how especially bombed out his selections are. So we have names like GCP Infrastructure Investments, Next Energy Solar, Tritax Eurobox, but a lot of these names are on something like 40% discounts and really high yields. Of course, the question is, do they stay cheap and what is the catalyst for things to get better? But that'll be an interesting one to watch in the next 12 months.
Yeah, you can find all the details of those portfolios in the magazine. For the final section, though, it's almost a microcosm of this Whistle Stop Tour because, Alex, it is the Whistle Stop Tour of the world, around the world in eight investment trusts as the big feature. You know, as that suggests, you look across the investment trust universe, you look at the Z scores and pick out some that are particularly attractive, combined with recent share price performance as well. And maybe you could just say a little bit about that process, but also I was interested in the UK trust you picked out this year, which, just to be annoying, I'm going to say we shouldn't necessarily name. We shall try and whet the appetites and let people pick up the magazine. But it has quite an interesting approach to UK equities that has worked really well this year.
Yeah, no, and yeah, I promise I will not reveal anything. In terms of the format, I mean, it's now quite a well-worn format, this Around the World in Eight Investment Trusts, obviously based on the 19th century novel of the similar name by Jules Verne. It's kind of this sort of globe-hopping screening of the sector. It's aimed to do a couple of things. We try and pick out, and sorry to return to the subject of discounts, but we are looking, as you alluded to with the Z score, stocks that are trading on two factors. One, their Z score, which shows how cheap they are relative to their trading history based on their discount. The second factor, based on their recent trading momentum. So that's one of the things we sort of hope to achieve with the feature. The second is kind of highlighting the real diversity of the investment trust universe. So, you know, if you want exposure to fast growing Indian manufacturing picked by stock pickers, based in India, or Korean technology, or a private European credit, or asymmetric bets on US treasuries by, you know, one of the smartest New York hedge funds out there. It's all available in the investment trust world, so that's how it works. We pick out eight investment trusts, as the title alludes to, and it does include two UK trusts, as mentioned. So the unnamed UK trust, you know, you highlighted and in the piece, it did kind of blow me away how under the radar some of these trusts have gone. You know, the UK Growth Fund that the screen identified, really interesting situation. It's fairly illiquid, but currently trading about a third below its disclosed NAV, which I think in reality is actually a fair bit higher already, because it has been on the end of seven or eight takeover bids, including some of its largest holdings in a portfolio of 40 or so small caps. I mean, that is a hit rate, which, you know, there's few fund managers out there are ever going to achieve in a given year. And no one's really sort of talking about it. The fund itself seems quite bad at talking about it as well. But that's just a function of some trusts' marketing and size, that they, you know, they maybe not so good at crowing about their successes. But, you know, in terms of takeovers, there are lots of ways, both simple and technical, of working out if a fund manager or stock picker is good at their job. As far as blunt measures go, though, I think this is pretty good. And it means that the trust is racking up the cash from premium bids. Shares are going sideways. Doesn't really make sense to me, but I'm glad the screen picked up on this one.
Yeah, indeed. I hope I haven't infuriated too many listeners by having us hype up this portfolio without saying what it is, because it is really interesting. But as I say, that is in print, and you know, maybe it'll be a fun guessing game as well. And if you find the whole thing very frustrating, you can just email me and I'll probably tell you. Anyway, that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you very much to all the contributors. Thank you to Chris. Thank you to Alex, to Dave, to Val, to Mitch, and to our producer, Maddie Atthorpe. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.